It's official. Come Monday, the name of this podcast will no longer be This Week in the CLE. It will be Today in Ohio. Same scintillating conversation, same cast of characters, but we've realized that This Week in the CLE sounds like a weekly news magazine about Cleveland. Today in Ohio is a much more accurate portrayal. Probably 60% of the content we discuss on here is Ohio-wide, with 40% of it being local. Today in Ohio, you don't have to change anything. If you're a subscriber, you'll still have it show up in your podcast menu. But for today, it is This Week in the CLE, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn, here with my colleagues Seth Richardson, Laura Johnston, and Lisa Garvin. Happy Wednesday, all.
Hello, everybody.
Happy Wednesday.
Good morning.
Seth, it's coming up on it, man. 6 days to Election Day. It's been a long haul. And you're not going to get any rest because the day after Election Day, you're into 2022.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the downsides of covering the off year is I get to then jump into the off year. So, you know, just all elections all the time, 3 straight years of elections.
It's going to be hot, though. It's good to be needed. Let's begin. Has the Cleveland Clinic come up with a powerful new weapon to contain breast cancer? Laura Johnston, this seems like one of the biggest stories to pop in Cleveland all year. If this is what it seems to be, what a step forward.
Yeah, this is going to target the most lethal type of breast cancer, preventing triple negative breast cancer. That typically doesn't respond to hormonal or targeted therapies and needs multiple types of attack to fight it. And so preclinical studies have showed that a single vaccination could prevent breast tumors from occurring and inhibit the growth of already existing breast tumors. So this is really good news. About 15 to 20% of the women diagnosed with breast cancer worldwide have this triple negative type. This is any breast cancer that does not express the genes for estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2/NEU. And that's hence the term triple negative. So this is the worst kind, the kind you don't want to get, and this is what we're targeting.
But an actual vaccine. I mean, we haven't had a vaccine for cancers, really. I guess that's not true. The PPV
Gardasil
vaccine is. Yeah, but breast cancer kills so many women every year, and so many more suffer through just horrible treatments to fight it. This is a gigantic step for them, and if it works, I imagine we'll start seeing this as a cancer fighting tool with lots of other cancers.
Yeah, I hope so. The clinic's partnering with Anixa Biosciences Incorporated on this phase one trial. They're going to start with patients with a high genetic risk for breast cancer and to spare them from undergoing preventative mastectomies. And actually, the study is funded by the U.S. Department of Defense. It's based on some preclinical research that was already published in Nature Medicine. And we're talking about 18 to 24 patients who have completed some early stage treatment. So I hope it goes really well. I mean, I feel like, I don't know the latest stats, but it was something about 1 in 6 women ends up with some kind of breast cancer. My mom had breast cancer, my mother-in-law. You feel like as a woman, it's just something you have to be constantly aware of. And there's a good chance you might have to go through it. So this would, I think, cure a lot of anxiety for women.
And the purpose of this trial, I mean, they'll be looking at the success rate, but it's really to determine what is the right dosage. They're ready to roll with this. And so in a few years, this could be a standard course of treatment. Very cool for the Cleveland Clinic to be involved in this and driving it. We'll have to see where we stand 4 or 5 years from now. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Why is the Ohio School Boards Association breaking ties with the National School Boards Association? Seth Richardson, this seems like more of the polarization of America where there's just so much divisiveness. I'd love to know if there are any urban districts on represented or in the voting block that made this decision. What's going on here?
Well, it sounds like it was a decision made by the Ohio School Boards Association itself. I don't know if they polled members or anything like that, but it all stems from this letter from the National School Boards Association to the Biden administration, you know, citing concerns about, you know, a lot of uproar at some of these school board meetings, right? And they were specifically talking about some, you know, threats of violence against school board members, which they said could be the equivalent to a form of domestic terrorism and hate crimes. since that letter, you know, it's kind of been seized on, you know, because obviously critical race theory and mask mandates have been really a hotbed of a lot of the political debate in the in these local elections coming up, you know, especially on the Republican side. And, you know, it's really been latched onto, and you've had several state school boards association, which, you know, we should clarify real quick, is the professional organization, not the, you know, not the state school board or anything. But you have states, you know, including Pennsylvania, Louisiana, and Missouri, and now Ohio, that have basically said they're going to separate themselves from the National School Boards Association because they just didn't agree with the content of the letter and were never asked about the content of the letter.
Yeah, it just seems like an overreaction, right? I mean, we've had protesters showing up at school board meetings, screaming at school boards, shutting them down. The National School Board Association starts to worry that this is some kind of national political plot, asks for federal help, uses strong language that many found offensive. But is that reason to withdraw your tie, or is it more the political statement joining into this whole phony anti-critical race theory thing that we've talked about before? It seems like a hollow political gesture more than a true ethical stand.
I think it's actually, I'm sure that the, you know, the political stuff does come into it a little bit, but you know, Rick Lewis, who is the School Board Association CEO, has been very adamant, like kind of basically pushing back on the, you know, the idea that a lot of parents have that critical race theory is being taught in the schools. He's been very clear about that. It is also worth pointing out that the former head of the School Boards Association, you know, had some critical things to say about critical race theory and resigned because of it. I think that it can actually be, in a way, it's almost like what was said in the letter, right? That, you know, some of these school board members were facing, threats of violence and whatnot. You know, if you don't separate yourself from this organization, are you then kind of in sort of a circular fashion putting yourself in danger of, you know, facing those threats of violence because now you're not separating yourself from the organization? So I think that probably played a factor in it too.
Okay, you're listening to This Week in the CLE. What is the apparent conflict of interest that the chairman of Cleveland's Planning Commission has involving the Irishtown Bend project? Lisa Garvin, Eric Isaac put this story together. I was pretty shocked. It's really not normal for the head of the Planning Commission to have any kind of role in a project he's voted on.
Yeah, this kind of doesn't look right. It doesn't smell right. The Cleveland Planning Commission chairman, David Bowen, is also a principal of Richard L. Bowen and Associates design firm, which was started by his father. Now, this firm is the one that's working with the George brothers, Tony and Bobby George, on a half-acre property at West 25th in Detroit. So he's helping them work on this building. It's a vacant building that's sitting there. It's got a big billboard on it. It's the last piece of the Irishtown Bend land acquisition that they need. And actually, the Port Authority is saying if they don't get this little piece of land, it's going to cost like $5 million more to shore up Irishtown Bend. So, and he's actually, you know, back in 2017 when they started talking about the Irishtown Bend project, Bowen, you know, said that he liked the project. And then all of a sudden, about 6 months later, the Georges bought that little acre site with the land and the vacant building. And that just seems like too much of a coincidence to me. And he should recuse himself on any votes, I think, now on Irishtown Bend. But when he was asked directly, would he recuse on any votes on Irishtown Bend? He says, quote, "It depends on where we are with things," unquote. And then he said, "If I had to, I would." So yeah, this just is fishy all around.
Well, the truth is he shouldn't have taken the project. After he voted on Irishtown Bend, you shouldn't be taking money to work on something that really runs counter to it. I mean, this is pretty scandalous. You don't usually see scandal at the City Planning Commission, but you got to think the other members of that commission are looking at him thinking, what are you doing? You're tainting all of our work. I mean, who does he think he is? Pat DeWine? You know, I mean, he should recuse. what's going on in Ohio? We got all these people that have gigantic conflicts of interest and they can't see it. And it doesn't seem like there's any recriminations for that anymore.
Well, but they are, the Port Authority is trying to move. They're taking steps toward taking that property by eminent domain. And they're saying that, you know, they would pay fair market value for that land, but it's certainly less than the $5 million it would cost them in over, you know, over the project to, you know, do it around this property. So, yeah, he needs to just wash his hands of this and recuse on any further votes on Irish Town Bend, in my opinion.
Yeah, and kind of renew his commitment to acting in the public interest, because this is a taint on that body. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Could Cleveland's port help with the logjam of container ships at ports on the nation's coast? Laura Johnson, we've all seen news of the big logjam out in LA, where there's all sorts of container ships that wait weeks before they can get unloaded because of a shortage of labor and other issues. It's interesting that Cleveland's port thinks it could have a role. I am skeptical.
You're ready to throw the flag on this one?
Yeah.
But I think this is a really cool story from our new business reporter, Sean McDonnell. But the Port of Cleveland wants to play a role in container shipping. They've been importing shipping containers since 2014, but only use about 6% of their capacity. And Port CEO Will Friedman says Cleveland's ready to take on some of that big shipping demand, in part because we're a day's drive from a large part of the United States population. And we're the third largest Great Lakes port in terms of volume, the only one that takes shipping containers. And we all know what we're talking about, right? The big steel boxes that go from a ship to a truck to a train. And by the end of this year, we'll have about 6,000 containers that's been imported. That's a 50% increase from last year. But yes, we are way, way smaller than Los Angeles, which takes in these mega ships that obviously cannot fit through the St. Lawrence Seaway. So it would require a lot of restructuring of how shipping works in this world.
Well, we're going to follow up on this, because I want to add up how many days would it add to the journey from China to go all the way around to the eastern side of the United States to get into the channel that gets here? How much fuel would that expend compared to waiting in LA with your engines not really running? It just seems like that's a pipe dream. Really save time? Would it add to the price? And I get that where our location is, we're close to so many people, so you could reduce trucking time once it's unloaded. But this seemed like, yeah, it would be great to help alleviate the LA backup, but is that pragmatic? Plus, you didn't even mention ice. You know, we're coming into the cold weather. Yeah,
not just ice. The fact that the St. Lawrence Seaway is closed for a big chunk of the year, from January through March usually. So yeah, we wouldn't be able to ship anything in through there. And I think, you know, we get a lot of ships from Europe already, and maybe we'll just have to concentrate on that part. But I mean, Will Friedman's talking about shipping from Asia through Halifax and then down through St. Lawrence Seaway. Obviously, he's actually talking about using canals and stuff and rivers more. I don't see that we're going to go back to that kind of transportation in this country, but I think it's worth a discussion, because what we have now, right, you know, isn't sustainable, and obviously isn't working very well.
Well, we need a discussion with numbers, what that adds to the cost of goods that are coming here. So we'll be doing a follow-up on that. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. With less than a week to go, what are the strategies of the two candidates for mayor of Cleveland in the final days, and who is appearing likely to win? Seth Richardson, I'm going to put you on the spot. Ask for your prediction.
Oh, if you're asking for a prediction, that's, of course. you know, it is honestly very hard to have a kind of solid prediction in this race, I think, just because, you know, unlike with, you know, a lot of bigger races, so to speak, right? There's kind of limited data to go on. That said, I would say that I'm probably leaning about like 65% that Justin Bibb wins, as, you know, opposed to Kelly winning. But because turnout's going to be so low, you know, I think calling any local race a done deal is probably a risky bet, especially when you consider that turnout is going to be, you know, what, around, I would say maybe like 65,000, which is not very high. It's going to be higher, I would assume, than 2017, just because it's an open race. But when you do have turnout that low, it does, you know, the old adage, right? This kind of cliche, it comes out down to turnout. So who gets out their base, who gets, you know, new voters kind of activated and whatnot. That's where I think Bibb probably has a slight advantage there. Strategy in the final, weeks has been, pretty interesting, all things considered. You've seen Kevin Kelly really hammering, frankly, a lot of Republican talking points, trying to, I think it's pretty clear that he's trying to court Republican votes with that. Talking about the trying to say that Bibb wants to defund the police, quote unquote, and stuff like that, calling him a radical, those sorts of things. It's the same playbook that we saw in 2020, and I'm going to guarantee that we will see in 2022 as well. And, you know, is it a winning strategy? And I don't know. We tend to think of Cleveland as this, it's only Democrats, which isn't totally true, right? There are Republican votes in Cleveland. The question is, are there enough Republican votes to really do it? With Bibb, you've seen, and also kind of the geography of where these two candidates are sort of focusing on, right? Kelly has really been focusing hard on the West side. I don't think that's, a surprise at all. Bibb has been a little more kind of all over, but really trying to, consolidate that East side support where, he didn't win too many areas over there, but he did very well over there in a lot of areas. And he did better than Kelly over there in a lot of areas, especially in Black communities. So I think you're going to see Bibb really try to consolidate a lot of the Black vote. And I would say that I think if Bibb is able to consolidate that Black vote and kind of hold on to the coalition that he had in the primary, I think that gives him a pretty distinct advantage.
Right. So you're going to be out with them both on Saturday, right? You're going to be seeing their strategy for a story we'll publish Saturday online and Sunday in the Plain Dealer.
Possibly. I mean, we'll have to see what they're doing, but, it's going to be a lot of knocking doors. That's essentially what this all goes down to. It's, you're not going to see the big, this isn't going to be like the 11th congressional district where they're having all these people come in at the last moment and they're having these, big rallies at the Agora or wherever. It's really going to be a lot of, knocking on individual doors, going to church services, trying to get people out. That's what a lot of it's going to be.
All right. So I do want to correct something. The Kelly campaign put out a press release yesterday saying a Cleveland.com poll showed he was winning. No, it's just not true. It's not a Cleveland.com poll. Our company's advertising arm in seeking data from people had a survey that was on our website. It was not contained to Cleveland. It went well wider than Cleveland. And it's just based on people who are on our site. And at one point yesterday, the results were showing Kelly was up by 7. And so they put out this kind of ridiculous press release saying Cleveland.com is calling him ahead. Not true. It's not a scientific poll. It's not based on the people who are voting.
Well, and
it's kind of shameless for them to put that out. Go ahead, Seth.
And you know who else used to do that kind of thing, right? When you think about who would use online polls and basically say that, oh, this shows that, I'm the top candidate and I'm the winner, right? Donald Trump did that all the time. After literally every single debate, he would go and find some online poll and say, hey, this proves that, I'm the winner. So again, just another kind of fascinating.
Yeah,
some of the strategy.
I just get my back up when a campaign says Cleveland.com is showing. Not true. Shouldn't have done it. They should have talked to us before they did a screen grab of our site and started talking about it. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What's the point of the Ohio Redistricting Commission meeting this week if it has no intention of drawing congressional maps before their deadline? Lisa Garvin, after they miss their deadline, this then goes to the full legislature, which is what Bob Kupp and Matt Huffman want. They don't want Mike DeWine, Keith Faber, and Frank LaRose making any calls on this, so they're boxing them out.
Yeah, they're going to have a meeting at 10 o'clock, their very first one, by the way, at 10 o'clock this Thursday. This is just a dog and pony show, just to kind of show that they're trying to make a little bit of an effort, but they're really not. They're trying to run out the clock. They still won't be approving any maps at this meeting before the deadline, which is October 31st. Like you said, it sends this back to the legislature. And what happens is that cuts off, like you said, Auditor Keith Faber, Secretary of State Frank LaRose, and Governor Mike DeWine will no longer have a vote on it because it goes to the legislature. And we kind of know what's going to happen there. So, and this doesn't allow allow any public comment. The Republicans are not producing their own map at all, and they won't be voting on any kind of GOP plan. So there's a November 30th deadline to approve the maps for a 10-year map. You have to have a third of the Democrats approve. If not, you get a 4-year map. So, yeah, this is it, well, like Matt, go ahead.
Matt Huffman and Bob Kopp have shown from the beginning they don't want anybody else involved, even though the voters went to the polls in big numbers and said this is how we'd like it to go in both the legislative districts and now the congressional district. They think they should have the full say. That's what they've engineered. Tomorrow is just a charade so they can say, well, we met, you know, we got together, we had a meeting. But they're just abdicating their responsibility to the people who voted in large numbers to fix this broken system.
And they don't have a map. They haven't produced a map. So when are we going to see the map? When it goes to the legislature? I mean, I you know, it's just crazy that they haven't produced one. And the Democrats have produced a map that fairly reflects, you know, the voting patterns of Ohio, you know, which they're looking at, you know, 8 GOP, 6 Democratic and 1 toss-up district. But in 2011, when they redrew the lines, it was 12 GOP districts and 4 Democratic districts. So they want that to continue and maybe even make it worse. It's a travesty.
I think it's going to be hard. This is harder than the legislative districts. We'll have to see how they pull it off. And we'll end up in court as soon as it's done. Anyway, you're listening to This Week in the CLE. Was the lower cost of doing business at Akron Canton Airport the real reason that Allegiant Air announced recently it would abandon Cleveland Hopkins International Airport? Laura Johnston, you called this when we talked about the abandonment of Cleveland. You thought that they'd be going back there. Cleveland's got high landing fees. Akron Canton is a very lonely place with lower fees. Is that the reason?
Well, it's part of it. And yes, I'm a big fan of CAK, so it's nice to see that something's heading back to there. They talked about the fees as a part of it, which in 2019, Cleveland's per landing average fee for the planes was $14.07, where Akron Canton's was $4.99. So pretty much a third of the cost. But there is also other factors. They say the customer base wanted Allegiant to fly from Akron Canton, and they're moving back, and they've been talking about it for about 6 months. They say they'll start in March, 4 destinations to start with, and then they plan to expand, but 3 in Florida and then Savannah, Georgia. Each will be served twice per week. Obviously, this is a leisure based business. They're not looking for business travelers to do this, and it's ultra low cost.
Do we suspect that other airlines at Cleveland with the high cost of doing business there might start to shift some of their travel from Akron?
That would be really interesting to see. Like if Southwest decides that they can keep their prices lower if they put some of their flights out of Akron, because they were at Akron and they moved to Cleveland, I think, in 2017. So it'd be interesting to see if this is the beginning of a trend. I mean, Akron is thrilled. The officials said they've been asking ever since they left, saying, why did you leave? What can we do to bring you back? So you better believe those people are having conversations saying, how can we make this work for you? And, well, and meanwhile, we have Cleveland saying, we want to spend $1 billion on a new airport.
Well, when United left, it created that vacuum. And so a lot of the airlines that were at Akron Canton moved to Cleveland. But this is economics. I mean, Cleveland has some of the highest landing fees for airlines in the country. They are talking about spending $1 billion to remake the airport. And these leisure travel airlines are 100% based on price. I mean, you and Layla have talked about, you don't care about the amenities. You want low price tickets when you're taking your family to Disney World. And right, this allows you to do it cheaper. I just wonder if this is more bad omen for what's going to happen in Cleveland.
When you look at the population of Northeast Ohio, these airports are 55 miles apart. And obviously a lot of people that fly out of Hopkins might be coming from Medina County or Summit County, and Akron, it's just as close. So, I mean, yeah, it's a further drive if you're coming from like Mentor, but this is convenient to a lot of people.
Well, and in Akron, you almost can park at the curb and walk in the front door.
You definitely can. I mean, you don't have to worry about getting a park and fly. You could just, you know, actually park and walk.
Yeah,
nice.
It's pretty easy. It'd be interesting to see what happens next. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Should we at Cleveland.com and the Plain Dealer keep reporting the results of horse race polls when we know they are no longer anything close to reliable? Seth Richardson, you made this bold proposal in a meeting last week that we stop doing so. I ask the readers of my text or of my column every week, the letter from the editor, what they think. It goes to 50,000 people by email every Saturday. Got an overwhelming response that I'll be writing about this weekend. I'm not going to give it away now, but what was driving you to make that proposal?
Well, I think we've seen in the past, you know, especially the past couple of years, really just kind of with the onset of Donald Trump, that, you know, horse race polling specifically, you know, has some flaws in it, whether it's the methodology that's being used, whether it's just people lying to polls, whether it's the way they contact people, they haven't been on. And, you know, I keep getting, and to be clear, I really like polling, but it's kind of a matter of, okay, you know, we kind of keep doing this out of inertia, right? Where a poll is released and, you know, it's a reliable pollster, but when you kind of take a look back, you know, it's not necessarily correct, or it didn't show anything that was correct. You know, you look at the 2020 election specifically in Ohio, and, you know, polls were showing a pretty close race here.
And it wasn't anywhere near that.
And it was, right. It was nothing. It was a blowout. Donald Trump won the state by 8 percentage points. Whereas, you know, most of the polls, and even the Republican leaning polls, you talk about, not to get too in the weeds, but Trafalgar is kind of known as this, they bake in kind of a Republican advantage to polls that others don't catch. And even they were still around 5 points off,
yeah,
which
so,
is pretty big.
Right. So the idea is there's nothing else we do that relies on what we know to be wrong information. It used to be weather. I said it in the column. There was a day where weather forecasting wasn't really much good beyond about 36 hours, but that's gotten way better. So you look at a 5-day forecast. Last week it was said it would be raining all this week. Man, they're right on the money. So this is really the only thing that we report that we know is wrong. And so you raised a very, very good question. What's fascinating to me is that I heard from people that felt very strongly we should, but they almost all seem to be involved in polling. Like every pollster you talk to says, yeah, polling is really challenged, except mine. You know, we do X, we do Y, but they're not. They're wrong. They're wrong over and over again, and they mislead people about voting. So I got a huge response to this one, and unlike some others I've written, it was a very clear consensus of what we should do for a variety of reasons. So look, Seth, I appreciate you bringing this up. It really fired a lot of discussion among our audience, got some good discussions going. That's what we try to do. And I will be back on Saturday with what we heard from people. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Is the closing of the Samus coal plant along the Ohio River related to the House Bill 6 scandal, or is this just something separate? Lisa Garvin, anytime we talk about coal plants lately, we're thinking about House Bill 6. What's the deal?
And the Samus coal plant is not one of the two coal plants that are currently being subsidized by ratepayers here in Ohio. This one is in Jefferson County. It dates back to the 50s. Here's what happened. Senator Frank Hoagland, who is the Republican in Jefferson County, you know, he inquired when they were debating House Bill 6. He's like, why should I vote for it if it's going to put the coal plant workers out of work? And then later ended up voting yes on it. So they felt like, I'm sorry, let me back up just a little bit. So apparently, he was convinced that the nuke plant bailout for the two nuclear plants would allow Samus to be financially stable. So they figured that would help. But now they're closing it at the end of 2028. 4 of the 7 units have already been shut down. That would happen last year. So the remaining 3 units will go offline in the next few years. I don't know. This just seems kind of weird. You know, the senator's like, I don't know why I should vote for it. And then all of a sudden he voted yes. So he got something that he liked.
So we're propping up some coal plants with big subsidies. Other coal plants are closing because they can't survive. Maybe it's the end of coal and the beginning of clean air across Ohio. We'll have to see. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. That does it for another Wednesday podcast. The next time we were talking with Seth Richardson, we will know who won the mayor's race and will be doing so on a podcast called Today in Ohio. Thanks, Seth. Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks to everybody who listens.